3. In the oil painting age that followed the end of the Renaissance, the depth of an artist can be accurately measured by the content of his portraits. To this rule, there is hardly an exception. All forms in the picture, whether single or in scenes, groups or masses, are fundamentally felt as portraits. Whether they are meant to be so or not is immaterial, for the individual painter has no choice in the matter. Even the landscape of the Baroque develops from composed backgrounds to portraits of definite localities, representations of the soul of these localities, which are thus endowed with faces. Nothing is more instructive than to observe how, under the hands of a real Faustian man, even the act transforms itself into a portrait study. It could be said of Hellenistic portrait art that it followed exactly the opposite course. Take two German masters like Lukas Cranach and Tilman Riemenschneider, who were untouched by any theory, and, in contrast to Dürer, whose inclination to aesthetic subtlety made him pliant before alien tendencies, worked in unqualified naivety. They seldom depict the act, and when they do so, they show themselves entirely unable to concentrate their expression on the immediately present, plain-specified bodiliness. The meaning of the human phenomenon, and therefore of the representation of it, remains entirely in the head, and is consistently physiognomical rather than anatomical. And the same may be said of Dürer's Lucrezia, notwithstanding his Italian studies and the quite opposite intention. A Faustian act is a contradiction in itself, hence the character heads that we so often see on feeble act representations, as far back as the Job of old French cathedral sculpture, and hence also the laborious, forced, equivocal character that arouses our dislike in two manifest efforts to placate the classical ideal, sacrifices offered up not by the soul, but by the cultivated understanding. In the whole of painting after Leonardo, there is not one important or distinctive work that derives its meaning from the Euclidean being of the nude body. It is mere incomprehension to quote Rubens here, and to compare his unbridled dynamism of swelling bodies in any respect whatever with the art of Praxiteles and even Scopas. It is owing precisely to his splendid sensuality that he is so far from the static of Signorelli's bodies. If there ever was an artist who could put a maximum of becoming into the beauty of naked bodies, who could treat bodily floridness historically and convey the utterly un-Hellenic idea of an inexhaustible outflowing from within, it was Rubens. Compare the horse's head from the Parthenon pediment with his horse's heads in the Battle of the Amazons, and the deep metaphysical contrast between the two conceptions of the same phenomenal element is felt at once. In Rubens, recalling once more the characteristic opposition of Apollinean and Faustian mathematics, the body is not magnitude, but relation. What matters is not the regimen of its external structure, but the fullness of life that streams out of it, and the stride of its life along the road from youth to age, where the last judgment that turns bodies into flames takes up the motif and intertwines it in the quivering web of active space. Such a synthesis is entirely unclassical. But even nymphs, when it is Corot who paints them, are likewise shapes ready to dissolve into colour patches reflecting endless space. Such was not the intention of the classical artist when he depicted the act. At the same time, the Greek form ideal, the self-contained unit of being expressed in sculpture, has equally to be distinguished from that of the merely beautiful bodies on which painters from Giorgione to Boucher were always exercising their cleverness, which are fleshly still life, genre work, expressing merely a certain gay sensuousness, e.g. Rubens's wife in a fur cloak, and in contrast with the high ethical significance of the classical act, have almost no symbolic force. Magnificent as these men's painting is, therefore, they have not succeeded in reaching the highest levels either of portraiture or of space representation in landscape. Their brown and their green and their perspective lack religiousness, future, destiny. They are masters only in the domain of elementary form, and when it is actualized, this, their art is exhausted. It is they who constitute the substance element in the development history of a great art. Footnote. Nothing more clearly displays the decadence of Western art since the middle of the 19th century than its absurd mass-wise rendering of nudes. The deeper meaning of study of the nude and the importance of the motif have been entirely forgotten. End of footnote. But when a great artist pressed on beyond them to a form that was to be capable of embracing the whole meaning of the world, he had necessarily to push to perfection the treatment of the nude body if his world was the classical, and not to do so if it was our north. Rembrandt never once painted an act, in this foreground sense, and if Leonardo, Titian, Velasquez, and among moderns Menzel, Leibel, Maris, and Manet did so at all, it was very rarely. And even then, so to say, they painted bodies as landscapes. The portrait is ever the touchstone. By that test, Rubens, and among moderns, especially Feuerbach and Birkeland, lose, while Goya, Daumier, and in Germany, Oldach, Weismann, Reisky, and many another almost forgotten artist of the earlier 19th century gain, and Marie passes to the rank of the very greatest. But no one would ever judge masters like Signorelli, Mantegna, Botticelli, or even Verrocchio by the quality of their portraits. The equestrian statue of Can Grande of 1330 is, in a far higher sense, a portrait than the Bartolomeo Colleoni is. And Raphael's portraits, the best of which, for example, Pope Julius II, were done under the influence of the Venetian Sebastian del Piombo, could be ignored altogether in an appreciation of his creative work. It is only with Leonardo that the portrait begins to count seriously. Between fresco technique and oil painting, there is a subtle opposition. In fact, Giovanni Bellini's Doge, Loredano, is the first great oil portrait. Here, too, the character of the Renaissance as a protest against the Faustian spirit of the West betrays itself. The episode of Florence amounts to an attempt to replace the portrait of the Gothic style, as distinct from the ideal portrait of late classical art, which was well known through the Caesar busts, by the act as human symbol. Logically, therefore, the entire art of the Renaissance should be wanting in the physiognomic traits, and yet the strong undercurrent of Faustian art will kept alive not only in the smaller towns and schools of Middle Italy, but also in the instincts of the great masters themselves, a Gothic tradition that was never interrupted. Nay, the physiognomic of Gothic art even made itself master of the southern nude body, alien as this element was. Its creations are not bodies that speak to us through static definition of their bounding surfaces. What we see is a dumb show that spreads from the face over all parts of the body, and the appreciative eye detects in this very nudity of Tuscany a deep identity with the drapery of the Gothic. Both are envelopes, neither a limitation. The reclining nude figures of Michelangelo in the Medici Chapel are wholly and entirely the visage and the utterance of a soul. But above all, every head, painted or modelled, became of itself a portrait, even when the heads were of gods or saints. The whole of the portrait work of A. Rossellino, Donatello, Benedetto de Maiano, Mino de Fiesole stands so near in spirit to that of Van Eyck, Memling, and the early Rhenish masters as to be often indistinguishable from theirs. There is not, and there cannot be, I maintain, any genuine Renaissance portraiture, That is, a portraiture in which just that artistic sentiment which differentiates the court of the Palazzo Strozzi from the Loggia dei Lanzi and Perugino from Cimabue applies itself to the rendering of a visage. In architecture, little as the new work was Apollinean in spirit, it was possible to create anti-Gothically, but in portraiture, no. It was too specifically Faustian a symbol. Michelangelo declined the task. Passionately devoted as he was to his pursuit of a plastic ideal, he would have considered it an abdication to busy himself with portraiture. His Brutus bust is as little of a portrait as his De Medici, whereas Botticelli's portrait of the latter is actual, and frankly Gothic to boot. Michelangelo's heads are allegories in the style of dawning Baroque, and their resemblance even to Hellenistic work is only superficial. And however highly we may value the Uzzano bust of Donatello, which is perhaps the most important achievement of that age and that circle, it will be admitted that by the side of the portraits of the Venetians, it hardly counts. It is well worth noting that this overcoming of, or at least this desire to overcome, the Gothic portrait with the classical act, the deeply historical and biographical form by the completely ahistoric, appears simultaneously with, and in association with, a decline in the capacity for self-examination and artistic confession in the Goethean sense. The true Renaissance man did not know what spiritual development meant. He managed to live entirely outwardly, and this was the great good fortune and success of the Quattrocento. Between Dante's Vita Nuova and Michelangelo's sonnets, there is no poetic confession, no self-portrait of the high order. The Renaissance artist and humanist is the one single type of Western man for whom the word loneliness remained unmeaning. His life accomplished its course in the light of a courtly existence. His feelings and impressions were all public, and he had neither secret discontents nor reserves, while the life of the great contemporary Netherlanders, on the contrary, moved on in the shadow of their works. Is it perhaps permissible to add that it was because of this that that other symbol of historic distance, duration, care and ponderation, the state, also disappeared from the purview of the Renaissance between Dante and Michelangelo? In fickle Florence, whose great men one and all were cruelly maltreated, and whose incapacity for political creation seems, by the side of other Western state forms, to border on sheer bizarrery, and more generally wherever the anti-Gothic, which in this connection means anti-dynastic, spirit displayed itself vigorously in art and public life, the state made way for a truly Hellenic sorriness of Medicis, Sforzas, Borgias, Malatestas, and waste republics. Only that city where sculpture gained no foothold, where the southern music was at home, where Gothic and Baroque joined hands in Giovanni Bellini, and the Renaissance remained an affair of occasional dilettantism, had an art of portraiture, and therewith a subtle diplomacy and a will to political duration. Venice. 4. The Renaissance was born of defiance, and therefore it lacked depth, width, and sureness of creative instinct. It is the one and only epoch which was more consistent in theory than in performance, and, in sharp contrast to Gothic and Baroque, the only one in which theoretically formulated intention preceded, often enough surpassed, the ability to perform. But the fact that the individual arts were forced to become satellites of a classicist sculpture could not, in the last analysis, alter the essence of them, and could only impoverish their store of inward possibilities. For natures of medium size, the Renaissance theme was not too big. It was attractive indeed from its very plainness, and we miss consequently that Gothic wrestling with overpowering imprecise problems which distinguishes the Rhenish and Flemish schools. The seductive ease and clarity of the Renaissance rests very largely upon evasion, the evasion of deeper reluctances by the aid of speciously simple rule. To men of the inwardness of Memling or the power of Grunewald, such conditions as those of the Tuscan form world would have been fatal. They could not have developed their strength in and through it, but only against it. Seeing as we do no weakness in the form of the Renaissance masters, we are very prone to overrate their humanity. In Gothic, and again in Baroque, an entirely great artist was fulfilling his art in deepening and completing its language. But in Renaissance, he was necessarily only destroying it. So it was in the cases of Leonardo, Raphael and Michelangelo, the only really great men of Italy after Dante. Is it not curious that between the masters of the Gothic, who were nothing but silent workers in their art, and yet achieved the very highest that could be achieved within its convention and its field, and the Venetians and Dutch of 1600, who again were purely workers, there should be these three men who were not sculptors or painters, but thinkers, and thinkers who of necessity busied themselves not merely with all the available means of artistic expression, but with a thousand other things besides, ever restless and dissatisfied in their effort to get at the real essence and aim of their being. Does it not mean that in the Renaissance they could not find themselves? Each in his own fashion, each under his own tragic illusion, these three giants strove to be classical in the Medicean sense, and yet it was they themselves who in one and another way, Raphael in respect of the line, Leonardo in respect of the surface, Michelangelo in respect of the body, shattered the dream. In them the misguided soul is finding its way back to its Faustian starting points. What they intended was to substitute proportion for relation, drawing for light and air effect, Euclidean body for pure space. But neither they nor others of their time produced a Euclidean static sculpture, for that was possible once only in Athens. In all their work one feels a secret music, in all their forms the movement quality and the tending into distances and depths. They are on their way not to Phidias, but to Palestrina, and they have come thither not from Roman ruins, but from the still music of the cathedral. Raphael thawed the Florentine fresco, and Michelangelo the statue, and Leonardo dreamed already of Rembrandt and Bach. The higher and more conscientious the effort to actualize the ideas of the age, the more intangible it became. Gothic and Baroque, however, are something that is, while Renaissance is only an ideal, unattainable like all ideals, that floats over the will of a period. Giotto is a Gothic and Titian is a Baroque artist. Michelangelo would be a Renaissance artist, but fails. Visibly, the plastic in him, for all its ambitiousness, is overpowered by the pictorial spirit, and a pictorial spirit too in which the northern space perspective is implicit. Even as soon as 1520, the beautiful proportion, the pure rule, that is, the conscious classical, are felt as frigid and formal. The cornice which he put on to San Gallo's purely classical façade of the Palazzo Farnese was no doubt, from the strictly Renaissance standpoint, a disfigurement. But he himself and many with him felt it to be far superior to the achievements of Greeks and Romans. As Petrarch was the first, so Michelangelo was the last Florentine who gave himself up passionately to the antique, but it was no longer an entire devotion. The Franciscan Christianity of Fra Angelico, with its subtle gentleness and its quiet reflective piety, to which the southern refinement of ripe Renaissance work owes far more than has been supposed, came now to its end. Footnote. It is the same noble simplicity and quiet greatness, to speak in the language of the German classicists, that produces such an impression of the antique in the Romanesque of Hildesheim, Gönrode, Paulinseller and Hersfeld. The ruined cloisters of Paulinseller, in fact, have much of what Brunellesco, so many centuries later, strove to obtain in his palace courts. But the basic feeling that underlies these creations is not something which we got from the classical, but something that we projected onto our own notion of classical being. And our own notion of peace is one of an infinite peace. We feel the rest in God to be an expanse of quietude. All Florentine work, insofar as sureness does not turn into the Gothic challenge of Verrocchio, is characterized by this feeling with which Attic sophrosyne, prudence, has nothing whatever in common. End of footnote. The majestic spirit of the Counter-Reformation, massive, animated, gorgeous, lives already in Michelangelo. There is something in Renaissance work which at the time passed for being classical, but is really only a deliberately noble dress for the Christian-German world feeling. As we have already mentioned, the combination of round arch and pillar, that favourite Florentine motif, was of Syrian origin. But compare the pseudo-Corinthian column of the 15th century with the columns of a real Roman ruin, remembering that these ruins were known and on the spot. Michelangelo alone would tolerate no half and half. Clarity he wanted, and he would have. The question of form was for him a religious matter. For him, and only for him, it was all or nothing. And this is the explanation of the lonely, fearful wrestlings of this man, surely the unhappiest figure in our art. Of the fragmentary, the tortured, the unsatisfied, the terribile in his forms that frightened his contemporaries. The one half of his nature drew him towards the classical and therefore to sculpture. We all know the effect produced upon him by the recently discovered Laocoon. No man ever made a more honest effort than he did to find a way with the chisel into a buried world. Everything that he created he meant sculpturally. Sculpturally, that is, in a sense of the word that he and he alone stood for. The world presented in the great pan, the element which Goethe meant to render when he brought Helena into the second part of Faust, the Apollinian world in all its powerful, sensuous, corporal presence. That was what Michelangelo was striving with all his might to capture and to fix in artistic being when he was painting the Sistine ceiling. Every resource of fresco, the big contours, the vast surfaces, the immense nearness of naked shapes, the materiality of colour, was here for the last time strained to the utmost to liberate the paganism, the High Renaissance paganism, that was in him. But his second soul, the soul of Gothic Christian Dante and of the music of great expanses, is pulling in the opposite sense. His scheme for the ensemble is manifestly metaphysical in spirit. His was the last effort, repeated again and again, to put the entirety of the artist personality into the language of stone. But the Euclidean material failed him. His attitude to it was not that of the Greek. In the very character of its being the chiseled statue contradicts the world feeling that tries to find something by and not to possess something in its artworks. For Phidias, marble is the cosmic stuff that is crying for form. The story of Pygmalion and Galatea expresses the very essence of that art. But for Michelangelo, marble was the foe to be subdued, the prison out of which he must deliver his idea as Siegfried delivered Brunhilde. Everyone knows his way of setting to work. He did not approach the rough block coolly from every aspect of the intended form, but attacked it with a passionate frontal attack, hewing into it as though into space, cutting away the material layer by layer, and driving deeper and deeper until his form emerged, while the members slowly developed themselves out of the quarry. Never, perhaps, has there been a more open expression of world dread in the presence of the become, death, of the will to overpower and capture it in vibrant form. There is no other artist of the West whose relation to the stone has been that of Michelangelo, at once so intimate and so violently masterful. It is his symbol of death. In it dwells the hostile principle that his demonic nature is always striving to overpower, whether he is cutting statues or piling great buildings out of it. He is the one sculptor of his age who dealt only with marble. Bronze, as cast, allows the modeller to compromise with pictorial tendencies, and it appealed therefore to other Renaissance artists and to the softer Greeks. The giant stood aloof from it. Footnote. It has never been sufficiently noticed that the few sculptors who came after Michelangelo had no more than a mere workaday relation with marble. But we see at once that it is so when we think of the deeply intimate relation of great musicians to their favourite instruments. The story of Tartini's violin, which shattered itself to pieces on the death of the master, and there are 100 such stories, is the Faustian counterpart of the Pygmalion legend. Consider to E.T.A. Hoffmann's Johannes Kreisler the Kapellmeister. He is a figure worthy to stand by the side of Faust, Werther and Don Juan. To see his symbolic significance and the inward necessity of him, we have only to compare him with the theatrical painter characters in the works of contemporary romanticists, who are not in any relation whatever with the idea of painting. As the fate of 19th century art romances shows, a painter cannot be made to stand for the destiny of Faustian art. End of footnote. The instantaneous bodily posture was what the classical sculptor created, and of this Faustian man was incapable. It is here, just as it is in the matter of love, in which Faustian man discovers, not primarily the act of union between man and woman, but the great love of Dante and beyond that, the caring mother. Michelangelo's erotic, which is that of Beethoven also, is as unclassical as it is possible to be. It stands sub specie aeternitatis, and not under that of sense and the moment. He produced acts, a sacrifice to the Hellenic idol, but the soul in them denies or overmasters the visible form. He wills infinity, as the Greek willed proportion and rule. He embraces past and future, as the Greek embraced present. The classical eye absorbs plastic form into itself, but Michelangelo saw with the spiritual eye and broke through the foreground language of immediate sensuousness. And inevitably, in the long run, he destroyed the conditions for this art. Marble became too trivial for his will to form. He ceased to be sculptor and turned architect. In full old age, when he was producing only wild fragments like the Rondanini Madonna and hardly cutting his figures out of the rough at all, the musical tendency of his artistry broke through. In the end, the impulse towards contrapuntal form was no longer to be repressed, and, dissatisfied through and through with the art upon which he had spent his life, yet dominated still by the unquenchable will to self-expression, he shattered the canon of Renaissance architecture and created the Roman Baroque. For relations of material and form, he substituted the contest of force and mass. He grouped the columns in sheaves, or else pushed them away into niches. He broke up the stories with huge pilasters and gave the facade a sort of surging and thrusting quality. Measure yielded to melody, the static to the dynamic, and thus Faustian music enlisted in its service the chief of all the other arts. With Michelangelo, the history of Western sculpture is at an end. What of it there was after him was mere misunderstandings or reminiscences. His real heir was Palestrina. Leonardo speaks another language. In essentials, his spirit reached forward into the following century, and he was in no wise bound, as Michelangelo was bound by every tie of heart, to the Tuscan ideal. He alone had neither the ambition to be sculptor nor the ambition to be architect. It was a strange illusion of the Renaissance that the Hellenic feeling and the Hellenic cult of the exterior structure could be got at by way of anatomical studies. But when Leonardo studied anatomy, it was not, as in Michelangelo's case, foreground anatomy, the topography of human surfaces studied for the sake of plastic, but physiology studied for the inward secrets. While Michelangelo tried to force the whole meaning of human existence into the language of the living body, Leonardo's studies showed the exact opposite. His much-admired Sfumato is the first sign of the repudiation of corporeal bounds in the name of space, and as such it is the starting point of Impressionism. Leonardo begins with the inside, the spiritual space within us, and not with the considered definition line, and when he ends, that is, if he ends at all and does not leave the picture unfinished, the substance of colour lies like a mere breathing over the real structure of the picture, which is something incorporeal and indescribable. Raphael's paintings fall into planes in which he disposes his well-ordered groups, and he closes off the whole with a well-proportioned background. But Leonardo knows only one space, wide and eternal, and his figures, as it were, float therein. The one puts inside a frame a sum of individual near things, the other a portion cut out of the infinite. Leonardo discovered the circulation of the blood. It was no Renaissance spirit that brought him to that. On the contrary, the whole course of his thought took him right outside the conceptions of his age. Neither Michelangelo nor Raphael could have done it, for their painter's anatomy looks only at the form and position, not the function of the parts. In mathematical language, it is stereometry as against analysis. Did not the Renaissance find it quite sufficient preparation for great painted scenes to study corpses, suppressing the becoming in favour of the become, and calling on the dead to make classical ataraxia accessible to northern creative energy? But Leonardo investigated the life in the body, as Rubens did, and not the body in itself, as Signorelli did. His discovery was contemporary with that of Columbus, and the two have a deep affinity, for they signify the victory of the infinite over the material limitedness of the tangibly present. Would a Greek ever have concerned himself with questions like theirs? The Greeks inquired as little into the interior of their own organization as they sought for the sources of the Nile. These were problems that might have jeopardized the Euclidean constitution of their being. The Baroque, on the other hand, is truly the period of the great discoveries. The very word discovery has something bluntly unclassical in it. Classical man took good care not to take the cover, the material wrapping, of anything cosmic. But to do just this is the most characteristic impulse of a Faustian nature. The discoveries of the New World, the circulation of the blood, and the Copernican universe were achieved almost simultaneously and, at bottom, are completely equivalent. And the discovery of gunpowder, that is, the long-range weapon, and of printing, the long-range script, were little earlier. Leonardo was a discoverer through and through, and discovery was the sum in one word of his whole nature. Brush, chisel, dissecting knife, pencil for calculating and compasses for drawing, all were for him of equal importance. They were for him what the mariner's compass was for Columbus. When Raphael completes with colour the sharp-drawn outline, he asserts the corporeal phenomenon in every brushstroke. But Leonardo, in his red chalk sketches and his backgrounds, reveals aerial secrets with every line. He was the first, too, who set his mind to work on aviation, to fly, to free oneself from Earth, to lose oneself in the expanse of the universe. Is not this ambition Faustian in the highest degree? Is it not, in fact, the fulfillment of our dreams? Has it never been observed how the Christian legend became in Western painting a glorious transfiguration of this motif? All the pictured ascents into heaven and falls into hell, the divine figures floating above the clouds, the blissful detachment of angels and saints, the insistent emphasis upon freedom from earth's heaviness, are emblems of soul flight, peculiar to the art of the Faustian, utterly remote from that of the Byzantine.